Well, good morning, everyone. I didn't think I'd see anyone. About 3 weeks ago, I was in the Virgin Islands sailing, and they told me how to celebrate Christmas. They actually put a Christmas tree decorated up in the sand. Yeah. But one thing we know in Zen, of course, is to celebrate the seasons. And we embrace every season. So I'm back here. I have a 7-year-old granddaughter who complains there's not enough snow. It's too warm. Welcome everyone. It's also that time of year when we make New Year's resolutions. And we all know about the jokes that surround New Year's resolutions. These aren't particularly funny, but just a couple. I have worked tirelessly in setting New Year's resolutions every January 1st. And you know what that means. Now you forget them quickly. Or how about, I'll go to the Zen Center every Sunday and start a daily meditation practice. Sound familiar? Yeah. Now here's my favorite. May all your troubles last as long as your New Year's resolutions. So why make New Year's resolutions? More seriously, however, New Year is a good time to reflect back in the past year, and to not reflect is unwise, really. And we can repeat bad patterns, bad habits, etc. Now, so we always want to ask ourselves what went well, what didn't go so well, do you notice any patterns, etc., and what are your intentions for the coming year to really follow those intentions. And so that's what I'm going to talk about today. As a Zen center, actually making resolutions is easier than you might think because it's part of our practice. It's consistent with our practice and will carry our practice along. And it's a resolution that many members of the center have already made. How many people are wearing raka suits? Stacy, at least, and I'm wearing one, and usually there are more. Ted's wearing a raka suit. If you see a person wearing this little bib-like thing, it means that they've taken these resolutions and made this commitment. They're resolutions like, I vow to not to lie, but to cultivate open and honest relationships. And I have 5 of them, and I'm not going to talk about all of them, but they're on our brochure today. And those are the ones we want to concentrate on. And what we might do with our resolutions, by taking the precepts, etc., eventually is to participate in something called the Jukai ceremony, J-U-K-A-I, or sometimes we just say just taking the pledge. And it really gives our practice a real goal and direction to follow. There are 16 precepts that I'll mention, but it's very much a part of our practice. Jukai. In Buddhism, we usually talk about our practice as really having 3 legs, like a tripod, and each is of equal strength. And one, of course, is right understanding. Sometimes we refer to wisdom. I don't like to use that word when I refer to myself, but right understanding. You take classes, you read, you understand. A second one is right conduct, which the precepts are about. And then the third is right meditation and right wisdom, etc. It's easy enough to sit on a cushion and try to just concentrate on your breath, etc. But to sit on knowingly, you have to have right understanding, etc. And if your life is messed up, really messed up through bad conduct, etc., you need the third leg as well. And so we think of these 3, little legs, etc., as a tripod again, right conduct, right understanding, right meditation, they all go together. So if your actions are thoughtless, etc., and you sit on your cushion, you can sit there, but it's not a healthy Zen. The 3 practices of ethical conduct, meditation, and insight or wisdom are the 3 parts of the Eightfold Path, what we call the 3 teachings. And these are things we should all be aware of, etc. The Eightfold Path is the 4th of the 4 Noble Truths. And I'm not sure if you all the noble truths, etc. But basically, they're divided into the three teachings. The first is right understanding. It includes two things: right understanding, right intention. Then we have right conduct, which is, if I can remember them all, is, let me see, right action. Help me out a little bit.
Speech and
language.
Speech, yeah.
Yeah, okay. In livelihood, etc. And then the third part, of course, is our right meditation, which is right effort, right meditation, and right concentration. And, you know, those are really basic. When I talk about the Four Noble Truths, we're really talking about something that's usually more closely connected to what we call early Buddhism. And it's not... it's not talked about in Mahayana Buddhism as much, though it does underline our teaching. And so we should be really familiar with the Four Noble Truths and the three teachings. And I say all that because Ben Connolly just happens to be teaching a course in the Four Noble Truths in January. So again, it's a real foundational teaching and something that you should be familiar with. So what's the Jukai, taking the precept ceremony? What's it about? And remember, I'm suggesting as a path, basically, you think about working with some of the precepts, etc., eventually leading up to making a commitment to live your life that way. And that's what the Jukai ceremony, I call it Jukai. We try not to use Japanese words and things like this, but that's how I learned it years ago. Etc. And during the ceremony, you actually make a commitment I vow to try to live my life this way. And there are actually 16 precepts. I'm going to name them, but don't try to remember them. 16 is too much. I once gave a talk where I had 8 things that people should do, and after somebody says 8, when I ran out of 5 fingers, that was it, you know. So don't try to remember these things, but just to get an idea, basically, of what what it's about a little bit. We take of 3 refuges, and we take a refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And here, the Buddha is to be understood as our inner Buddha nature. You know, the way people are, the goodness of the world, if you will. Taking refuge in the Dharma really is to take refuge in the teaching that really releases that natural goodness that you have. And taking refuge in the Sangha isn't just our Sangha, the group of practitioners here, but it's all beings, etc. And so that's pretty abstract. The next 3, remember there are 16, are called the 3 pure precepts. And the way I usually express them is the first is stop messing up. In other words, they say, you know, don't do bad. And then the second is, get yourself in shape. You know what I mean? Shape up, you know, once you've stopped doing bad. And the third is help other people. Now, those are very abstract. And thus we have the 10, really mindfulness sutras, 5 of which are on your brochure. Now, they're much more concrete, etc. So that's a lot to remember. Don't try, etc. I'm just going to talk a little bit about it. Now, first, what's a precept and how is it to be understood? On the surface, at least, it's an ethical commitment, etc. You know, I won't kill, I'll do good, you know, on and on. I won't steal, things like this. In our American way of taking the precepts, precepts have 2 parts. One is a negative part, don't kill. Now, the other is the positive part, be generous, if you will. And usually when we work with the precepts, we start with the negative side first. You know, just like the old thing about don't mess up. You know, kind of get your life in order before you can really start helping other people, etc. And I think because at the end of the talk and at the end of the messages, etc., we always chant the 4 bodhisattva vows. And they give you a good idea of what a precept is. They're really aspirations that are basically unobtainable. Beings are numberless, vowing to freedom, right? Dharma gates are boundless, vowing to enter them, you know, things like this. Delusions are inexhaustible, vowing to extinguish them. So those are very typical precepts. and they have to be understand. And so precepts basically are a practice, and their very openness, etc., gives you endless opportunities to kind of play and learn with them, etc. And that's why it becomes such a deep part of our practice, etc. It becomes our practice. Norman Fisher, one of the best known Soto Zen teachers in North America now, I should say Central America as well, who's been here the last two summers, says all Zen practice is precept practice. He says Zazen is precept practice, where you're making a commitment and working with an aspiration, if you will. One thing I might mention, if you Google precepts, Buddhist precepts, you're going to find all kinds of interpretations. And almost everyone makes their own. So I just kind of mentioned that people have a slightly different slant on some of these things. Okay, why take the precepts? Now, the fundamental question a precept asks is, what prevents us from living the way we want to live our life, etc.? And contrary to what we usually hear in Mahayana Buddhism, Zen is rooted in moral values. We will not be able to settle our mind if we are embroiled in harmful behaviors, in thoughts, etc. In sitting meditation, we develop our attention and our awareness. And we sit there and we worry about, what is arising? And that's just great. But it's only a first step in our practice. The next step is working with the precepts, etc. And really making ourselves the compassionate beings we are. There are two great legs to Zen Buddhism. One is the great philosophic systems that we have, like Yogacara, etc. But the other is great compassion, etc. So just sitting is great. You have to learn to hold your attention. You have to learn to recognize awareness when it comes up. But again, it's just the first step. You have to mature. You have to vow. You have to learn to live the vowing life, because that's what we do. When I became a priest, I didn't say, I'm going to be a Zen priest. That's pretty cool. But Norman Fisher also says, and this is true for me, he says, it wasn't what I thought it was going to be. And he says, and by the time I figured it out, it was too late. And that's kind of true for me. I had a house for 30 years about a mile away in Linden Hills. And so this was a natural place for me to come. And so my Buddhism, my practice, isn't necessarily purely Mahayana. But basically, I did this to live a vowing life. I did this to become a better person and help other people become better people, etc. And I do that. I did that through working with the precepts, etc. And I'll talk more in a minute about how we basically do that. Okay. Well, I just wanted to interject in here a little bit about, are humans inherently good or inherently bad? Because the precepts kind of address this, and we want to understand that a little bit. If we think back to maybe the Stone Age or something like this, and when I worked, I was an archaeologist, and I did that kind of stuff, we can think of people doing good and bad just for survival state. You know what I mean? People are not genetically and inherently good or bad. They rise to certain situations that we might now interpret it, as bad or good, something like that. So it's not, genetically ingrained part of us, etc. In the Christian view, people will sin if given a chance. I kind of like that. For whatever reason, I don't know. Something's wrong here. But anyway, think of Adam and Eve, etc. And so you need commandments. You need God to instruct you and watch you, etc. You need the threat of heaven and hell to lead a good life, right? Etc. In Buddhism, we have this idea, it's one of our main principles, etc., that inside us, we have something called Buddha nature, that we have an innate compassion. We are innately good, etc. But things get in the way, and dust gets on the mirror, etc. If you're familiar with the Platform Sutra and things like this, etc. And so basically, part of our practice is just to work towards unveiling that Buddha nature that's in us. And one of the great parts about it, and one of the implications, is that all people can become Buddhas. There were times in Buddhism in the past, etc., when only certain people were thought to be able to become enlightened and could get the training, etc. And in our Mahayana view of Buddhism, we say we all have Buddha nature, everyone, etc. And that's a very important in our practice. And thus, the chants we're going to do, you know, we don't say, may those high aristocratic priests who've been approved for enlightenment, you know, they may be enlightened. And we say all beings. We say all beings. And I think that's something really important about our practice, etc. And we should be kind of aware of that. Okay, part of taking the Jukai ceremony is actually sowing a rakasu. And how many people have sold a rakasu? I'm sure there's a bunch of people around here. Okay. I just wanted to mention this because I'm trying to encourage people basically to and I'll mention in a minute, start working with a teacher you know, working with the precepts, etc., and then eventually making the commitment in the Jukai ceremony basically to live a life of vowing, which I think is very important. It gives us aims. And people have been doing this for thousands of years, etc. So why sow a rakasu, if you will? And that's this little thing. It's really a bib, really. It represents the kesa, or you're not wearing yours, which is the bigger robe, if you will, that we usually use wear more formally. So this just represents the larger robe, if you will. And what it signifies, among other things, is that I have made that commitment. And the way you wear your bib, the way you take care of your bib, it show, you know, is an important part of your Buddhist practice. It shows that you care, etc., that you're being careful when you do this, etc. Colors vary. You can see I have a brown one. Stacy has black. Okay. Actually, they're traditionally three colors of these things. I just mention them just for background information. If you take the precepts in the Jukai ceremony, typically you get a dark blue one. If you go through ordination to become a priest and during your training, you wear a black one. If you pass through your training, you wear a brown one like this, which means that you can be an individual teacher, if you will. Now, one reason we sew a rakasu, and we're very fortunate to have a couple, you know, sewing masters, if I can call them that. Our original abbot here, Katagiri Roshi's wife, Tomoe, was, you know, our first great sewing master here. Now we have Rosemary Taylor, who's Tomoe's kind of retired as her eyesight went. And she and I had many great conversations. And it usually started like this. Guy, that's horrible. Just horrible. Horrible. And I learned that there's a little instrument called the stitch remover. You know. And the reason I mention that is because when you sew your rakasu, it's really a form of meditation. And as you take a stitch, you say, I take refuge in the Buddha. Take another step. I take refuge in the Dharma, and on and on. And my way was usually curse, curse, curse. I had a kind of a wandering little line, etc. But if I can make it, anyone can make it. So I just kind of mentioned that it's just a wonderful practice. There are many ways to practice and take a vow. For example, you know, you can do it through your work. You know, I bow to be the best boss possible, you know, and compassionately. You know, I do art or whatever. And the way we start in Buddhism really is through taking the precepts and expressing that. And then eventually we hope that what grows in us through that practice is expressed in the way we interact with people around us, which I think is very, very important. So you study yourself basically. You learn about yourself basically when you sew your rakusu, etc. You know, careful stitch after stitch, etc. And we have to remember that the rakusu is really Buddha's robes, etc. And I mentioned how we wear it and how we care for it, etc. Is a reflection of our teaching, if you will. Okay, so how do you work with the precepts? I'm hoping that, and some of you will certainly take up precept practice because I think it's a great practice, etc. You'll see that there's more to working with the precepts than just saying, I want steal, I want misuse sexuality, I want lie, etc. And I want to look at two of these different ways of practicing with the precepts, etc. The first is, and this you can see how this leads us into a very deep understanding of Zen and compassion, etc. And there are really three levels we can think of as working with the precepts. The first level is the literal level. I want kill, that's the literal level. If you think about it a little bit, basically that's hard and almost impossible. When I go to Uptown, I walk across the lawn, and I come back that way, and I'm sure I'm crunching little critters under my legs of feet as I walk across the garden, etc. The second level is what we call the bodhisattva level. And the bodhisattva, really, we think of ourselves as bodhisattva, you know, people who have taken on the goal of compassion and helping all beings. And remember, those four chants we chant at the end of the talk today are the bodhisattva chants. Beings are numberless, vowing to free them. You know, things like this. Delusions are inexhaustible. Those are the bodhisattva chants. So this is a level of compassion. And I think we can all think of situations in which we might kill. Let's say there's somebody with a machine gun going in to shoot up all kinds of people in a theater. Sounds familiar, etc. And we have a way to kill that person. Would we do that? Would we do that? And most of us probably would do that. And so this is the bodhisattva level. The third level is what we call the Buddha level. And in Mahayana Buddhism, basically we think of two great worlds out there. And one's called the conventional world. And if you haven't studied this or you're not familiar with it, it sounds on first hearing, kind of odd. The other world is what we call the ultimate world. It's just the unity world. And one way to think about the two, and the way I tend to think about it is, if we really think of the world out there, it's just a bunch of energetic movement, if you will. You know, just energy. The quantum world, you know, things like this. And so what we do when we're little kids, as we grow, you know, as we learn to talk, mother says, that's a kitty. That's a car. Watch out. You know what I mean? That's a wall. And so we learn to label and name things in what's otherwise just this unity, etc. And, of course, it doesn't mean that there are not forces out there that we can't apprehend. That there are obdurate things out there we have to deal with. And I always think of, to save money, I'm going to eat rocks. It doesn't get you very far, does it? You know what I mean? In the summer, I'm going to walk across the lake. Doesn't get you very far. But the key point is that basically we learn to label. And when I was an anthropologist, etc., we studied people from around the world, and we realized that they labeled and understood parts of the world. They divided it up in different ways. And now, as our Western culture is spreading around the world, it all looks like one, right? But if you can go back, I have a colleague, or I had a colleague, who worked with people in New Guinea Highlands, for example, who had quite a different way of dividing things up, etc. So this is the problem with the Buddha level, that if there's just this ultimate world, That means there's no good, no bad, right? There's no lying, no not telling lying. Okay? And so how do you deal? How do you work with the precepts if there's no harm? You know, no helping, no compassion, etc. And this is the Buddha's middle way, where you work with one foot, basically, in the conventional world, another foot in the ultimate world. And that's part of our practice. And the challenge for us to live a real Buddhist life, if you will, if I can use that expression, etc., is that understanding. You know, that understanding that, you know, we necessarily have to live in a conventional world. That's where we are. It's a world where there's no, let's say, no bus speeding down the road. There's no speeding, no bus. But we know if we jump out in front of it, there's a consequence, right? But we also have to understand the ultimate world, etc. And so this is a very important part of our teaching, is how we sit with these things, because they become like koans. You know, these kind of things. You know, what's the sound of one hand clapping? You know, that kind of thing. You know, how do you be good in an ultimate world? You know what I mean? And so this is really a deep understanding. And to me, what awakening means, in our practice, etc., is that understanding in how you do it. And I could talk much more about that, but I will not. So you can see that basically precepts looked at this way go far beyond just pure ethical conduct. You know, they really enter into an understanding of the way things are, etc. Now, the other way, and I mentioned there are two ways of practicing I'll mention, and we might call the 12-step approach, if you've been through a 12-step group. And so, if we say something like, take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, how do we do it? I mentioned this is very abstract, so how do I actually do it? One answer is the three pure precepts, practice them. And this sounds like the 12-step part, where you stop messing up. You don't take your drugs. You don't get drunk with alcohol and things. And then after that, you know, you work on really improving your health to become a better person. And then only then do you go out and start to help other people. Okay. I might mention that for people who've worked with the precepts, precepts are difficult to work with all at the same time. Now, there's just too much. And so the way we usually practice is to take some part, and you can look at the five parts on the brochure, etc., and you can just say you work with one for a while. So you need a plan, etc. Another thing that I found that's very useful in working with the precepts is to reword them to fit your own life, etc. You know, you might not... when we use the word idea of killing, etc., you know, maybe harming is a better word for us. You know what I mean? And so we want to reword the precepts, etc., to fit our own situation. And then you might want to think about forming a vow-sharing group, etc. So let's look briefly at just the first five precepts that are on the brochure. And I vow not to kill, but to nurture life, however you want to say that, etc. You can say, I vow to live compassionately and harmlessly. Not killing can be understood as not harming, especially not harming the body or psyche of another. So you can see that you can take each of these precepts and you can really expand them in many ways. Some we think, thus physical violence and abusive behavior, which includes physical threats, extreme displays of anger, maliciousness, etc., are a kind of killing. In cultivating life, we encourage open inquiry into and discussion of the Dharma. So there's a lot to think about when you think about that first precept. You know, I won't kill, but I'll nurture all life, etc. The second one is I vow not to steal, but to receive what is offered as a gift, or sometimes is expressed, but to be generous myself. So rather than stealing, part of your practice, etc., is to be very generous. And being generous isn't just being generous with money, but it's being generous with time, etc., things like this. And you can see we could talk a lot more about this. So this precept expresses the bodhisattva's commitment to live from a generous heart rather than from an avaricious mind. And again, you can think endlessly of what all this means. The misuse of authority and status is a form of taking what is not given. And I'm sure if we sat down with little discussion groups, etc., we could really... And that's what part of taking the precepts is, and sitting with the precepts. The third one, I vow not to lie, I vow not to misuse sexuality, but be caring and faithful with my own and others' relationships. For example, everyone coming to the Zen Center in any capacity has the right to be free from sexual harassment. And we could go on and on about that. And the fourth one is, I vow not to lie, but to be truthful. And the last one is, I vow not to intoxicate with substances or doctrines, but to promote clarity, etc. And notice that we say doctrines. You can intoxicate with, for example, you can get intoxicated with watching too much television, for example, or just babble talk. You know what I mean? So there's all kinds of ways that we can intoxicate our mind other than just drugs and things like this. Okay, nearing an end here. Why work with a teacher? And this is a big point of what I'm going to point out. When we look at the precepts and we look at the various levels, for example, the bodhisattva level, the Buddha level, etc., when we look at the other way about not messing up and things like this, these are very hard to do by yourself. I found one of the best ways to work with the precepts is to work with a teacher, etc. Remember I mentioned that a lot of the precepts are really embedded in these large theories, Yogacara, Madhyamaka, Huayan, all of these big things that you've probably never heard about, etc. And so how are they integrated into that? And so you need a knowledgeable teacher, it seems to me, to help you do that. We're fortunate here at the Zen Center to have a mentoring program. And if you're a member, for example, you can meet with a mentor. And it's really up to you and your mentor, etc., to decide how many times you're going to meet. Once a month? Once a week? I found it depends on how my thought's going. If I'm really thinking about something, I might meet somebody once a week. Then I might go through this long period, etc. I would suggest that you take advantage of that program if you can. So what about the resolutions, etc.? And this is the last page, etc. It says, I vow to work with the precepts in 2015. And you can see if you're coming to the Zen Center and you're coming to sit, it's kind of a natural resolution to make. You know what I mean? It's something that's going to really deepen your practice, deepen your understanding. Remember the three legs of our practice. Right understanding is part of it. And so just sitting is just one of the legs, right? But you also need right conduct. So think of the three legs, etc., and how you're going to do that. Now, if you're not a member of the center, become one. And I'm just saying that because it gives you access to the mentoring program, etc. If you look at the brochure, and don't bother, but if you look at the bottom, it says, Happy New Year. And then in parentheses it said, to be read as a Zen koan. Why saying Happy New Year is that kind of an inappropriate Zen saying? Now, I'm not going to answer it for you. I'm going to leave you to think about it, etc. And it may have something to do with living in the moment, just as a little hint. Okay. Okay, well, that's it. Has anyone who's gone through the Jukai experience want to talk about that a little bit? Yep.
One of the things that happened for me is that my expectation would be that I would sell my whole rock to myself. And having expectations subverted is sometimes a very good thing, often a very good thing. And I had been putting the frame on, and I, before I sewed anything, I always had Rosemary check it. And Rosemary checked it, and she said it was okay. And then Tomoy came by, and it was not acceptable. And she had to, she's like, You go find Cindy. She'll help you make this house. I take this apart. I'm just like, oh, man. And then she comes to me and says, do you have extra fabric? And I'm like, oh, man, this is bad. And so I have an unusual seam in my rock suit that other people don't have. And she worked on it, and then it came time to leave, and I said, well, would you like me to take this home and work on it and put the frame back on? And she said, no, you mess up again. I have to fix again. And she took it away from me. And not only did I have my ass kicked by an 80-year-old woman who stands 4 foot nothing, but I had to let go of that idea that I was going to be the one to sell my whole rock suit. And so there's a lot of, you know, it's interesting. People have a lesson that they learn, and it's, you never know what it's going to be. You have no idea what you're going to have come up in your face when you do that until you do it.
Right.
But, yeah.
And I agree. And my experiences were even more severe. But I say that only because, remember, this is a practice. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And if my seams kind of wandered up and down like the waves of an ocean, etc., obviously my focus and concentration weren't particularly good. Mm-hmm. And so all of this comes from the depths of your heart. But as Kate says, when a little 80-year-old woman says, "God, horrible, horrible." Anyway.
And she's scary, man.
Yeah, she's good. Dave, you want to say something? No? Okay, anyone else? Yeah.
I'm going to just describe, and it's really hard to describe kind of what the immersion of sewing is like, because it was totally new to me, but... And I can't even picture myself being in this state, but I do remember, going along the outside edges is a really, really a series of just really long straight lines. So it's really easy to kind of lose time. And at my old apartment where I was sewing at home, I had some downstairs neighbors who I just hated because they were always out in the parking lot, like yelling and partying and blasting music and revving car engines and fighting and like. And I was sewing in my, and this was summer, so there was always someone out there, but I was sewing at home over a period of several hours, and I just heard them coming outside, getting ready to do their thing, and it was just like background noise, and it didn't register at all. And I remember just hearing them and hearing like kids show up and then yell at their kids, and I just kept sewing like without all the usual stories. Like it would just take, normally I just hear one voice downstairs and all the stories would come in my head like, God, these people are awful. it was so bizarre to just be in this total immersion and just let them do their thing, and they, you know, they come out, they're noisy, they go away, it's like an ocean wave or whatever. And yeah, I had no experience with sewing, so yeah, I'd highly encourage everyone to do that.
One last word on sewing, and then we'll move on. There's something called male sewing anxiety. I just mentioned it. Anyway, I don't know how well I presented this, but I think at least you see the point. etc., that if you're going to continue coming to the Zen Center, and if you're going to develop a meditation practice, etc., you know, just sitting isn't enough. You know, you've got to live the vowing life. And, of course, we all screw up, right? And that's one reason why we work with a teacher. And sometimes when we form a vowing group, you know, of peers, you know, sometimes it's helpful to say, I'm having a hard time, you know, with this. You know what I mean? And it's a way for us to grow. And so for me, when you enter into this kind of practice, I might want to say that taking the Jukai, and this is an important thing I didn't say, taking the Jukai ceremony is not a conversion. You know, there's no ism involved. In fact, the very word Buddhism is a Western construct that in Asia they just talked about the teachings of the Buddha, etc. And so we were at a phrase in the 19th century when we were naming everything. You know what I mean? All the animals and plants and things like this and the varieties of religious experience. So you can be an Episcopalian and take the pledge. You can be a Jewish person, a very Jewish person, and take the pledge. And in fact, I mentioned Norman Fisher a number of times, who's very much a Jewish guy. And so when he comes here in the summer to give a presentation, he also goes to the Jewish Center and gives a presentation, etc. So again, it's like Buddhism in general. It's not for us a religion, but rather it's a way to live our life. And 2015 is a good time to finally stop messing up.